This is a risky dode of risk assessment for Mayor Risk LLC, an editor of the North Africa Journal. The discussion on Libya that follows was recorded on the 9th of January. It was with analyst Alessandra Bruno, which took place a day or two before the two warring parties agreed on a truce. Although there have been some minor breaches to the ceasefire, there has been a diplomatic effort that saw the emergence of Russia as a serious power broker ahead of the Berlin conference. The talk was conducted through regular phone, hence the quality of the audio.
Thank you, Alessandro, for taking a moment to speak to us and share your thoughts with the audience. I think today I'd like to go back to some of the discussions that we had about specifically about Libya, as things seem to be seemingly accelerating. Just for for the audience, today is the 9th of January 2020, and the latest news from Libya suggests that all the apparent diplomatic frenzy that you see in Europe and elsewhere seem to not bear any fruit, considering that Haftar's last comment was that there's not going to be any ceasefire, we're going to keep going. On the military front, I think the latest suggests that there have been clashes between Sirte and Misrata. That's sort of the southern region closer to Tripoli. And to be frank, there's probably a lot of boots on the ground in Tripoli. Apparently, from what we're hearing from mercenaries from Africa to Russian mercenaries to agents working for France, and I would guess the Italians, everybody's there. Chinese drones are there. Chinese drones purchased by United Arab Emirates are there. At the end of the day, do we need a sort of a final, I'm not sure what the right term is, a final bang, big bang, to sort this mess out, or will sort of the return to a status quo of nothing happening and we keep hoping for peace is going to continue to lengthen the misery in which the poorly beaten people are in?
Well, that is the big question, because on the one hand, if General Haftar did gain an upper hand, he has some strength, but obviously not too much, not enough to take Tripoli, because he has been on the outskirts of Tripoli for the past 9 months, at least, I think since last April or last May, he's been on the outskirts of Tripoli. So this is the final move, accelerated the impetus is accelerated by the fact that Erdogan, president of Turkey, has decided to revive Ottoman ambitions, and that he wants some greater energy security to prevent the agreement between Greece, Israel, and Cyprus for the gas pipeline. So I think Turkey does not want that. So they want to make a breach to Tripoli and secure that whole area. After all, Haftar is backed by the Egyptians, so if that were the case, Turkey would control that whole coastline. And I wouldn't be surprised if Turkey will make inroads in Tunisia as well, because there is a strong Muslim Brotherhood party, which is one of the allies of Erdogan. After all, Erdogan is the representative of the Muslim Brotherhood, in a sense, in Turkey. So Tripoli and Tunis fit into that strategy. And that said, how Italy is not, which has backed the Tripoli government, the government of al-Sarraj, may not be too pleased about Turkey's effort to back the very same horse they're backing, because if Turkey takes over, if Turkey enters Tripoli with the full, with a much more organized military force than anyone has right now on the ground, it would be an official force. I think it would not be a mercenary force, or hopefully it would not be a force of militias, because that's one of the problems that Libya has. Too many militias and too few real armies. It would displace Italy's role. In other words, we can forget Eni, the Italian energy company, remaining in charge of the most profitable oil fields in the country and gas pipelines. Mm-hmm. I think eventually the Turkish oil companies and oil and gas company will start to take over, because they're not going to do launch a major military operation, which is going to cause some political risk for Erdogan at home. After all, how many foreign missions has Turkey participated in, other than those involving protection of the borders from Kurdish issues to do with Kurdish fighters? Mm-hmm. I think such an intervention by Turkey would be a major one with major goals involved. Yeah. In many ways, I think Italy is the biggest loser here, other than the Libyans have been, I'm talking in geopolitical terms.
Yeah, let's bring it back to sort of the real basics of this. I mean, obviously, everybody's rushing into this. Mm-hmm. Philosophically, though, does it boil down to a conflict between the Muslim Brotherhood and their Salafist brethren? The Muslim Brotherhood, mainly now formed through a camp or a relationship between sort of the Turks and the Qataris on one hand, and their Salafist brethren, including, I think, the so-called Madkhalis, who bring their power from Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and the generals in Egypt. Does it boil down to this? It sounds very iffy in terms of explaining the conflict in these terms.
Yes, and also General Haftar has nothing to do with these Salafists in personal ideals. I mean, Haftar was one of the backers of the original Libyan revolution of 1969 that removed the monarchy. And he was close to Colonel Gaddafi, who was a secular, although he did leverage on some Islamic tradition. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Green Book that he wrote does have that tradition included, but Gaddafi ruled Libya in extremely secular terms. So Haftar's alliance with the UAE in Saudi Arabia and some of the militias, the Madkhalis, for example, is entirely incongruent from the philosophical point. And actually, just a few days ago, Haftar described his effort to take Tripoli as a jihad. So he's using strange language that doesn't befit his role and certainly does not promise anything good as far as the Tripolitanian attitude to life is concerned. This Tripolitania, Tripoli was once a place where cruise ships would stop, and was famous for its beauty and easygoing lifestyle.
But what about the obsessions of the Gulf countries? I mean, one would argue Egyptians is really, the Egyptian regime is void of ideologies. It's mostly a militarist regime, just like we see in neighboring Algeria, where it's really there's no ideology, but mostly a militarist.
Yeah, protecting the military interests and their businesses.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the Gulf monarchies, their obsession boils down to an ideological fight, the way you would see it happening between Saudi Arabia and Iran, for example, on the other side. Mm-hmm. Is it the same story happening here in the Libyan case, which I find very ironic and bizarre in many ways, because, look, the Muslim Brotherhoods are, like you said, are largely in power in Tunisia. They have a political branch in Morocco. They certainly have a minority or a small minority branch in Algeria.
And
they haven't really created a major, major problems in the region, except if one sees the Turkish incursion as a risk for the Gulf monarchies and are doing everything they can to destroy the Turkish power base, so to speak, which is sort of the Muslim Brotherhood in general. But I'm trying to understand the philosophy behind
I think one key to understanding the philosophical side from the discussion that you make, which is why are the Gulf monarchies involved? Well, there is one Gulf monarchy that isn't involved, and it is backing Turkey, Qatar. We still have an ideological conflict between Qatar and the Saudi Arabia and the UAE, even though it's a bit milder these days. But Qatar is still, not enjoying diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia. So I think it's more Qatar here, perhaps, that's in a more subtle way, backing Turkey, encouraging Turkey to do this, and using Libya as one of the battlefields to fight. I'm not sure, in fact, how to describe it, because it's still unclear what Qatar and Saudi Arabia are fighting over. Mm-hmm. I think that it's that the Qatari key is important to consider here, more so than the Turkish one. Turkey, certainly Erdogan does have these grandiose Ottoman ambitions. Yeah. And I would back them if they would bring stability back to the area. But it's not clear that this would, especially if the rumors that Turkey might use militias, and we have all kinds of mixed militias of all kinds of different ideology and different ethnicities, simply because in that part of the world right now, that's the way to make money, is to be a fighter. It's how else to explain the phenomenon. You have people from Sudan and Chad fighting for both Haftar and Sarraj, depending on who pays most. So it's become an employment center for mercenaries.
And I can confirm that there's also been recruitment efforts by private security outfits down in South Africa. I mean,
oh, of course,
in favor or in favor of Khalifa Haftar.
Whoever mostly pays most, and
yeah,
it's actually Khalifa Haftar has the money.
He does.
Because of the backing. But Qatar may incur, given what's happening now, double the efforts, even though Sarraj technically controls only a small portion of Tripolitania, the northern Mediterranean coast between, not even as far as Misrata from Sabrata, so it's a very small region. Even if that fight is resolved, we still also have the issue of Fezzan and the Misrata militias, which are outside of both Haftar and Sarraj.
But isn't he in control of the southern regions, including the borders with Algeria, where there's tremendous amount of oil?
It's talking about Fezzan, the deep south.
Okay.
Which is extremely porous, which is where all the migrants are coming from.
Yes.
The area bordering Chad and Niger, I believe.
Yeah.
I don't have a map in front of me, but I think it's Niger and Mali. So that's a key strategic area, considering why Europe needs and wants stability in Libya.
Yeah, and I can say, I mean, certainly the south is very important too. To your point, there's Niger, there's also certainly Chad. That forms these two countries form a sizable part of the border, the southern border area. And in those areas, there have been a lot of troubles specific to illegal gold mining, illegal mining in general.
Mm-hmm. And uranium mining.
Exactly. One thing that really, one country we haven't heard sort of involved in this discussion, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's sort of remotely involved, is really Iran, which, as you know, there's no sizable Shiite community in North Africa. It's a minority. And therefore, one would think that Iran has no, you know, play in the geopolitics in the region. But the relationship between Turkey, Qatar, and Iran tends to be somewhat positive, and perhaps Iran is involved somewhat indirectly.
I'm not sure, because Iran also has a very good relationship with Russia, and right now Iran is so concerned about what's happening internally and on its own borders, and considering what's happened this week in Iran, and now there are suggestions that the jetliner, that Boeing 737 of the Ukrainian Airlines that crashed in the morning of January 8th, I believe, four or five hours after the Iran hit American bases in Iraq with missiles, that it was a missile hit. So it's unclear what could happen. But I'm sorry, what Iran may have, what interests. In fact, I don't really think Iran is involved here. When I was living in Tripoli in the good old days of the 90s, the Islamic Republic did have an embassy in Tripoli and a few officers, but and they had cordial relations with Gaddafi's regime, even though there was some tensions over the death of Imam Musa al-Sadr in 1979, or rather his disappearance. Nobody knows where he is. But other than that, I think Iran is very concerned with protecting its own direct sphere right now, to have any interest in obstructing anybody in Libya.
Yeah. So in terms of an outlook, or at least scenario playing here, you see sort of the situation getting bogged down where it is today, namely no major progress. I mean, certainly Haftar and his foes will continue to clash, and it will be difficult to keep taking each kilometer headed towards Tripoli. And then, or do you see the end of the stalemate eventually with Haftar winning, although with Turkey there, it's going to be difficult for the for Haftar to go head-to-head in confrontation with the Turkish military?
Yeah. There was something that happened today in the past 24 hours that made me think that perhaps Haftar will eventually have his cake, which is the Italian government invited Sarraj and Haftar to Rome yesterday to discuss the situation. But apparently they didn't, when they invited Haftar, they didn't inform Sarraj of this invitation, and Sarraj was angry. So he went to Brussels instead of Rome, and Haftar was left alone to discuss the situation with the Italian Prime Minister Conte in Rome. Now, why is that important? Because Italy has backed Sarraj until recently. But it seems like there is pressure on Italy, perhaps from the United States, which is probably quietly, I think Trump, Haftar is much more of a Trump man. So there might be some pressure from the United States on Italy to give concessions to Haftar, and Italy might be scrambling to discuss to make sure that under Haftar, the Italian oil company will continue to maintain its historic energy role in the country, which is the oldest of all the oil companies operating and the biggest.
So you think that there are signals that basically...
There are signals that Haftar may eventually take over. Turkey has issued the threat to send troops. It hasn't done so yet. But imagine, I think many Europeans are concerned, because if Turkey controls Tripoli, then it can start playing the same kind of game with militias and migrants in Libya that it has in Syria. In other words, Turkey has controlled the flow of Syrian refugees or refugees from the eastern side going to Greece and then the Balkans and up, demanding protection, essentially, from money from Europe in order to ostensibly finance the care for these migrants, and threatening when Europe misbehaves, threatening to release all, open the gates and flood Europe with migrants.
So it's weaponizing the refugee crisis.
It's weaponizing the migration. It would weaponize the migration issue on the Mediterranean coast, on the Libyan coast. So I think that's a very important issue for Europe and one of the cards that Sarraj can play. I'm not sure why a compromise government between the two cannot be arranged. And I'm also not sure why Libya cannot simply be split into two or three provinces as it was before Mussolini invented the idea of modern Libya uniting the two provinces in 1935, 34. So, because Libya, as we know it today, the United Libya, is a Mussolini concept.
Yeah.
It goes back to the colonial. And in fact, Tripolitanians were always much more favorable to Italian presence, the Italian presence, mm-hmm. than the Cyrenaicans. That's where the resistance was.
So we're facing then a couple scenarios then. Well, the most likely scenario, in my humble opinion, would be one basically where there's a status quo. And the status quo is basically 2020 becoming the equivalent of the last 3-4 months of 2019. The Haftar's troops being there, trying to get into Tripoli, and they're being refrained from the presence of the Turkish. The other scenario is one where basically Haftar takes over. What does a Haftar regime look like?
Well, given his experience, it might look a little bit like Gaddafi's.
Really? So you?
Yeah.
So this is a Gaddafi version 2.0.
Well, he's good. He's not going to be a sheikh. He's not going to be a king. He's going to be a general, a military in charge of a republic.
A 75-year-old military man.
Yeah. He's got. I think he has a son who might be interested in something. Beside all this Haftar, Sarraj, one of the most interesting aspects of Libya in 2019 was a suggestion that Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, would run in the elections in Tripoli. And his popularity has risen since the days of the Jamahiriya. So what role, he might play, or what role, if any, will any elections play in Haftar? That's a key question. Will Haftar be another al-Sisi, after all? Because let's say that Libya goes democratic. That would be a threat to the very people who put him in power.
Yeah, not going to work.
Al-Sisi is not going to want that kind of liberal attitude in his country, so he wants to make sure that whoever is in Tripoli will be close, not only ideologically with Egypt, but also institutionally. So that I think they would prefer some kind of military dictatorship masking as a republic.
So in terms of the threat assessment for the region, the primary one to be concerned is really Tunisia, because the border issue and the refugee issue could spill over into Tunisia and could destabilize it. It's a small government, or it's a small state. It's economically, it doesn't have really the financial capabilities to withstand the sort of influx that the Europeans have been facing for a while. Do you see that as a potential destabilizing factor for Tunisia?
Tunisia is, on one hand, one of the most exemplary countries in North Africa and actually the whole Arab world. Mm-hmm. It has a secular republic. It has one of the closest things to democracy in the whole Arab world right now. I think it's the only country that that emerged from the so-called Arab Spring with something optimistic. It's taken a while, they're building, but they are building something. Yeah. And so far, they've had a few incidents, some terrorist attacks, but who hasn't in the last period? And the country, the fact that it didn't have oil, I always saw as a blessing from an institutional and cultural point of view. I think people actually had to learn something and develop skills and develop institutions. So the government, the people have a stake in the government and vice versa. Mm-hmm. When you have oil, it's like having free money. There's no incentive to improve yourself or to improve the country. So Tunisia is the little diamond at the tip. And also it's blessed from the climate point of view and geological and agricultural. It has it's small desert, but not too much, beautiful coastal line, huge tourism potential, and excellent relationship with the Europeans.
Yeah, and culturally it's a very diverse culture. I mean, it certainly has, a collection of liberals, modernists, Islamists, traditionalists, left, and that makes it an interesting place.
And it's secular.
Exactly.
Even though the Muslim Brotherhood is powerful there, women, for example, enjoy more rights in Tunisia than any other Arab country that I can, other than Syria, that is.
Yes.
Syria is the only other one which had the same liberal constitution in the sense of protecting...
Lebanon a little bit.
Lebanon as well, okay. But Lebanon is always at risk of... given its position of civil war, there's always that edge. Instead, Tunisia had the opportunity of civil war, and it didn't.
So, in terms of your final take of where, if you were to put your money, where would you think things going to go?
Well, let's say Sarraj and Haftar were two horses. I would probably bet on Haftar.
At the moment, you think he will be able to?
At the moment, yes. There's something that meeting in Rome. Suggests to me that even the Italians are giving up on Sarraj. Now, to understand the importance of that, Sarraj landed in Tripoli accompanied by an Italian boat. So even right now, the only thing Sarraj can hold on to, the only string, is the fact that it is the UN-recognized government. But that could change with realistic expectations on the ground.
Yeah, and on that point, if a Haftar victory takes place, what's typically the response of the so-called international community? They sort of say, the king is dead, long live the king, now we're going to support this one?
Well, I think if Haftar can bring some kind of stability and perhaps with Saudi money and UAE money, there's something for everyone in all the militias, perhaps he can at least stabilize the country enough that some kind of evolution can take place afterwards.
But
we need, there's no transition, direct transition to democracy until some kind of stability is achieved. The question is, what do Tripolitanians want? Tripoli is still the largest city and still the capital. What do they want? It's unclear, but I think everybody has had enough of this situation, which is, after all, since 2011 that perpetuates without any hope in sight.
Yeah, I think the fear, from folks in Tripoli is the potential retaliation against them if Haftar takes over, and I think those are some of the things that obviously the Libyans will have to deal with, and eventually I hope that there's going to be enough pressure on if he takes over. And by the way, I'm still I still believe that it's not going to happen. I think that there's going to be regardless of sort of the Italian position, at the end of the day I think still the Turks are hunkering down there. And they're gonna go after they're gonna support the Tripoli based government as long as they possibly can.
They might. But there are examples throughout the region, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, that even the mightiest armies, you know, with all kinds of equipment, yep, and bases, fail in the face when they're dealing with a militia.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's Turkey really want to get bogged down in another one. I don't know if Erdogan, see, he plays a lot of, he bluffs a lot and exaggerates a lot. I'm not sure to what extent he really
is committed to.
He wants to go. How far does he want to go?
Yeah,
how much does the Turkish public want to go?
Absolutely, and I think at the end of the day, you know, to what extent his military is stretched with what's happening with their involvement in you know, in the southern borders of Turkey and all these problems. So I think at the end of the day, you're absolutely right. I mean, to what extent can a country like Turkey, with all its military capabilities, at the end of the day, look, it's not a global power. It's a regional power. Maybe it feels that it has the ability to go to Libya and impose, you know, its solution to the problem. On the other hand, one has to be careful. We've seen, you know, countries that are, you know, more powerful than Turkey go on campaigns that they have lost, they completely have lost. I mean, look at the French in the Sahel. It's turning out to be a disaster.
But that's the problem. And France teaches everybody this lesson. They lost Algeria after 5 years of fighting.
Yeah.
From 1957 to 62. And they had to go with the tail between their legs.
Yeah.
And then they left Vietnam before that.
Yeah, and on the other hand, you know, could the Turkish presence galvanize the Libyans that have not really sided with Haftar, but all of a sudden, at least the tribes anyway, all of a sudden find themselves with, you know, a foreign power. It's bad to have Haftar, you know, do what he's doing, but at least he's a Libyan. There's some level of justification.
Yes. Now, there is a Turkish minority in Tripolitania. There are many prominent families that have Turkish descent.
Sure.
But this goes back to, the same goes in Tunisia and Algeria probably. After all, the Karamanli was a Turkish family. They ruled Libya for years. And their major business was piracy.
Yeah.
Few Americans know that the first ever foreign intervention of an American army was in Libya in 1812 with the Marines.
You know, I was going to start an editorial that would introduce the idea of we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel in the region in general. Tunisia has had its elections. You know, is it the best president? Is it the best parliament? One would argue probably not. But what's the alternative, right? Algeria, you know, has gone through the past virtually 11 months in turmoil. And finally, the guy who drove that turmoil, who was responsible for that turmoil, at least from a personification perspective, General Gaid Saleh, has died. You cannot even dream of a Hollywood scenario, like I said, like that one.
Well, they're all in their 80s.
Yes, I think most of them are pushing 80s, if not late 70s, but mid to late 70s. But it's a generational conflict that we were witnessing. But there has been a revival of what's called the Hirak movement, which is sort of the anti-regime movement that sort of brought the voice of the people in the forefront of what's going on in Algeria. And even though the transition is still not as good as it should be, or it could have been, there is still a transition going forward. It might take several years before we see the real impact of the Hirak, even though most of the pro-Hirak activists tend to believe that there hasn't been really a victory yet. I tend to disagree. I think that there is, you know, the tracks for the trains have been laid right now. What needs to be done is basically sort of the non-violent work that needs to be done. And so, you know, with that and Tunisia, when Morocco continuing to show signs of stability, You know, the editorial was about to focus on sort of perhaps we're seeing a little bit of ray of light at the end of the tunnel. Is the conflict, and that's sort of the conclusion for this for our talk, is what we're seeing now part of the end, or the end of the conflict, the beginning of a ray of hope that you see at the end of the tunnel, or wishful thinking?
There is hope. After all, let's put it in numbers. What's the population of Libya? At most, Libyans, I'm talking about maybe 3.5 million, at most.
Yes.
That's the size of a city.
It is.
In Europe. So if we put it in numbers, there are many more people in North Africa living in stability than not. Because despite everything that's happened in Algeria, and this is actually a very positive thing, despite the weakness, the collapse of politics, what we saw is not so much a collapse of institutions, but the collapse of individuals within those institutions. The institutions are still there. So whatever was done in Algeria in the past, something remains. There is the infrastructure from which to begin a new phase of politics. The problem with Libya is that the entire infrastructure was idiosyncratic. That's the way Gaddafi built it, perhaps on purpose, such that when he would be removed, it would collapse. But Libya is the smallest population in North Africa. So in those terms, it's the fewest number of people living in this kind of turmoil.
Yes, yes.
That said, it also, because of its situation, it's a magnet for trouble that can then spread throughout the region. So how this gets solved, I don't know. I think Sarraj may still be hoping that if the Turks come, some kind of European force will come to fight, but there's no way. Turkey is a NATO country, and so are all the EU.
You know, there's another point that's probably worth mentioning in comparing sort of the populations. I mean, the Libyans, more than ever, show how divided they are along tribal sentiments. And if you look at the 40-plus million Algerians, it's the opposite. They, if the past 11 months have shown what something, they've shown that basically the reason why the country is stable, it's largely because there is a nationwide consensus among the population, and probably among many
and
of the
generational
political elites,
too.
Exactly, that the country ought not to be divided along ethnic lines, the Berbers versus the Arabs, and the Islamists versus the Francophones. There's been this sort of nationwide agreement that if you start falling into these kinds of differences, you're going to find yourself, without any doubt, into a civil war. And to me, you know, you talked about earlier about the institutions that are still around and able to, you know, keep things stable. I would argue that the population, has played an enormous role in keeping things going and keeping things stable, for sure.
That's what's missing in Libya. Gaddafi ruled the country as a pan-African, so he promoted African nationalism more than he did Libyan nationalism. And so there's no sense of real nation belonging to a Libyan state, which is something, for example, one of the reasons why nobody would dare attack Iran is because Iran is very nationalist, even though it's an Islamic Shia country. It's Iranians have a very strong identity as Iranians.
Yeah.
And North Africans, because they were further away from the Ottomans during the Ottoman Empire period, they developed their own sense of nationalism. Tunisia and Algeria, for example, they have their own sense of statehood, as does Egypt. So they've always been more stable compared to the Middle East itself.
Well, yeah. So on that, I think we're assuming nothing changes. Let's regroup in about 3 months from now, assuming if things change in the meanwhile. I think it would probably be worth to do another round of discussion if, obviously, there is a break in the status quo going forward. And with that, thank you very much, Alessandro, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you.